From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, two unconventional actors. Jean Moreau starred in such French New Wave classics as Jules and Jim, The Lovers, and Elevator to the Gallows. She's broken the rules in her films and her life. Before Peter Coyote made the films E.T., Jagged Edge, and Outrageous Fortune, he was part of a radical street theater group and a member of the celebrated Haight-Ashbury collective, The Diggers. He's now starring in new movies by Roman Polanski and Pedro Almodovar. Jean Moreau and Peter Coyote coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House is denying a report that military exercises off the eastern United States are a dry run for military action in Haiti. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Boston Globe reports that a two-week training exercise dubbed Operation Agile, involving some 44,000 troops off the eastern shore and Caribbean, has ended. The exercise coincides with the recent developments in Haiti, and the report quotes a military source as saying the maneuvers were planned with Haiti in mind. Pentagon officials would not comment on the report or the exercise. White House Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers denied the report and said the operation had been planned as part of regular military routine and had nothing to do with the situation in Haiti. There have been calls from Capitol Hill for U.S. military intervention in Haiti in order to restore President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power, and the White House has said it has not ruled out that option. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The Clinton administration is seeking strict limits on peacekeeping operations in Africa. The United States is urging the United Nations not to send peacekeepers to Rwanda to help humanitarian efforts. The United States says peacekeepers should only go to the Rwandan borders, where there is little evidence of violence. Tens of thousands of refugees are camped along the borders. They fled the violence in the interior. Fighting has been very heavy in Kigali, the capital. The Africa policy change is part of a plan that Mr. Clinton signed earlier this month that will reduce American involvement in Africa. Members of the House and Senate are seeking legislation to cut down on the use of landmines around the world. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has this report.
A Senate subcommittee is close to approval of a bill to restrict the use of landmines. An estimated 100 million mines remain in place from past wars, from Afghanistan to Zanzibar. Congressman Lane Evans of Illinois testified for the Senate bill and said the old mines are like millions of assassins lying in wait. He said that in Bosnia, for example, even if there were peace,
the millions of landmines that have already been spread throughout that country will prolong that war for decades.
In addition to the bill, there is a pending treaty, which President Clinton is urging the Senate to ratify to restrict landmine use. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Women's rights activists are taking on the insurance industry for allegedly denying coverage to battered women. The activists say thousands of women have been denied health and life coverage because of their beatings, and they claim this has discouraged many women from reporting their abuse to their doctors and to the police. Some insurers say the policies are meant to protect battered women by removing the financial incentive for their attackers. The chairman of the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee says he'll introduce a bill to stop the discriminatory practice. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 6 points at 3,659. The Nasdaq is down 4 at 715. This is NPR. President Clinton says he's resisting pressure to quickly nominate a Supreme Court justice. The president had indicated earlier this week he'd announce a decision by today. But yesterday, the president said he still had some questions to resolve before announcing his choice. The hesitation might be a factor involving apparent frontrunner Bruce Babbitt, the current Interior Secretary. There are two other people thought to be top finalists, Arkansas Judge Richard Arnold or Boston Judge Stephen Breyer. Foreign ministers from the United States, Russia, and the five European Union countries have come up with a new plan they hope will at least suspend the fighting in the former Yugoslavia. But the United States and Russia are apparently still at odds over whether to lift the arms embargo. The BBC's Paul Reynolds reports from the site of the meeting in Geneva.
This is the first time that ministers from the major powers in East and West have delivered such a call. They want a cessation of hostilities for 4 months. This would be renewable. UN troops would interpose themselves between the forces. The ministers have also accepted as the basis for a political settlement a territorial division of Bosnia, which would give 51% to the Croats and Muslims and 49% to the Serbs. This is the heart of the whole problem, and it would require huge compromises by both the Muslim-led Bosnian government and by the Serbs. There's also a carrot in the communique for Serbia. It's told that sanctions might be suspended if the Bosnian Serb forces actually withdraw.
Paul Reynolds reporting. The Labor Department says consumer prices edged up 0.1% in April. The slight increase was led by a drop in energy prices and moderate food price costs. Consumer prices have risen at an annual rate of 2.3% so far this year. The report is likely to calm worries about inflation. Analysts say today's report on consumer inflation and yesterday's news about low wholesale inflation should settle financial markets. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with our weekly archive edition. The French New Wave director started making movies in the late 50s that broke many film conventions. Those films turned an unconventional actress into an icon. As we'll hear, Jeanne Moreau broke the rules on screen and off. She starred in Louis Malle's early films Elevator to the Gallows and The Lovers, and she starred in Truffaut's Jules and Jim as a bohemian woman who is adored by two men. She also starred in Truffaut's The Bride Wore Black, Bunuel's Diary of a Chambermaid, and Orson Welles' The Trial. Moreau has made about 90 films throughout her career and is now president of the French Film Commission. The Museum of Modern Art in New York recently held a retrospective of her films. Her latest film, The Summer House, is a comedy of manners about an exotic woman who comes to a London suburb. Last December, I asked Moreau if she identified with the role of an unconventional woman stuck in a conventional place.
Well, maybe. Maybe it happens. I mean, the way I was brought up and the surrounding, the family. It's true that once I've decided I would be an actress, then the doors opened up. It was not easy because my father was violently against it. And though I still have very close links with my father's family and my mother's family, it's true that I'm considered like an original. Mm-hmm. See what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. When you did you mean your father was violent or just violently against
your
career?
No, he was violent. At one point, he was physically violent. But now, time has passed by, and he's not here anymore. And if I think about the way he was brought up, his background, a peasant family in the province of France, I understand why he was so violent and why you reacted that way.
Did he physically try to stop you from acting?
No, he just hit me and I went away. Mm-hmm. That's all. But, and insults, I mean, it was a time when in his family, in this kind of society, being an artist, an actress was being a whore, you know, sort of. It was the equivalent of prostitution.
And that's why he didn't want you to go into the profession.
That's it.
You have a wonderful quote in the press kit for The Summer House. You said, "I have fought and shunned convention and routine all my life. Mm-hmm. Breaking the rules fascinates me." What are some of the conventions that you feel you've broken during your life?
Well, one of them we just spoke about, and breaking the rules, it's something natural because the rules have been addicted to make society calmer and better organized. The rules of marriage, the rules of all sorts of things. And as long as you break the rules but you don't hurt other people, it can be good.
Well, I think you've lived your life a step ahead of the times. For example, the first time you got married just a few days before you gave birth to
your child.
The day before. And
but that's not breaking the rules. It's just that we didn't want to get married, and then we complied because the families were so worried because of the name of the child. So at the last moment, we said yes, just to please the others.
and you've had lovers over the years who
well, I'm not the only one.
Absolutely. But
I didn't marry each time. That's the difference.
Right, right. But do you feel that the times have caught up to you? That you were ahead of the times?
Well, it's a very personal approach to life. I don't know if things have changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, there are other things that... I've never been promiscuous.
Mm-hmm.
I just always let my heart speak and came close to people who wanted to be close to me. I didn't expect to be scandalous just for the sake of scandal.
Were there consequences that you feel you paid during your life, either in your personal life or in your career, as a result of having broken certain social conventions?
Well, let's see. Well, maybe at some point some people considered me as an outsider, but as I didn't mix with that sort of people, I didn't mind, really. So I think even if I had to pay some price, it didn't hurt me really, because deeply rooted in me was the belief that I had to be true to myself, or true to that inner voice. I don't relate only with material things. I don't only rely on what I see and what I hear. I try always to be very closely in relationship with my intuition and in what is beyond what is seen, what is heard, and what is shown. I believe in the life of the spirit.
You start in the early films of Louis Malle. First film. Yeah, like Elevator to the Gallows, and then his film The Lovers.
Mm-hmm.
You start in Truffaut's early film Jules and Jim, mm-hmm. and then The Bride Wore Black. You had been in at least one film before that, or in several films before that. Was it different to work with the new wave directors than it was to work in your earlier films?
It was totally different. In fact, I started filming at the same time as I started acting on stage. I'm from the stage. My only ambition was to be on stage. I had never seen a film, was forbidden. It was considered scandalous. I was not allowed to go to see films, and I was not allowed to read the newspapers. That's the way I was brought up, as you can see. It's a very, very, very restricted discipline. So I started filming, and I must say, the new wave brought about a total different approach, a total freedom. The old films I had made, I never met the director. I was contacted by the producer. I would meet the costume designer, the cameraman. And then maybe two or three days before the first day of shoot, I would have a meeting with the director. The directors on the set, besides Jacques Becker, was not well known here, but was a great, great film director. They never gave an explanation, never asked something special. And I remember one day I approached the director and I said, well, please tell me exactly what you would like me to do in that scene. And the man looked at me and he said, well, aren't you an actress? I said, yes. Well, you were hired to act. Just do it. So, you know, I was quite flabbergasted, because on stage in the theater, the Comédie Française was very, very different. And when I was approached by Louis Malle, at the time I was doing Cat on Hot Tin Roof, Tennessee Williams, on stage, directed by Peter Brook, a very young man came to visit me with his two producers. And he was 24 and I was 29. And he came up And he explained me what sort of film he wanted to do. Very small budget, very small crew, hand camera, no makeup, shooting with a very light electrical group in the Champs-Élysées at night. Oh, I thought, God, isn't that marvelous? No makeup, because the big problem, I didn't look like any of the stars at the time. I was supposed to be not very good-looking. I had those signs under my eyes, a drooping mouth, and it took hours to make me up.
Did they try to make you look more conventional when they made you up?
Yeah, I mean, everything had to be erased. And when I looked at myself in the mirror, good God. And then suddenly, that was freedom. You know, just a base and a little powder. And I just had to look myself. That's all. And that was a great change. And the fact that it was a very small crew meant that there were no delays. We were moving on.
It must have been interesting to you to go from a family that forbade you to read newspapers and forbade you to see movies because they thought it was, trashy, and they thought acting was like prostitution. Now you were working with a director who was incredibly serious about film and who saw film as a great art form, as I'm sure you did, too.
Yeah.
Did that change your whole perception of the work?
I knew it must have been like that, but I do not regret the first films I did, because later on, rarely it happened to me to work with people that were less talented than all the names you've given, and at least I could be in charge of myself, you know. I had a knowledge of the camera, of the lenses, of tracks, of movements, of what was technically cinema was about, and I could be in charge of myself. But it's true that opening up with the new wave confirmed what I was seeking for. And there's something very, very strange.
What?
While talking with you and thinking about my father was violently against. In fact, now he's gone since about 10 years. I discover while speaking with you that all my life I always tried to prove to him that I was right. You know, it's funny. It gave me such an impulse. In fact, it helped me.
What, to take movies that seriously to help
and,
prove
and
that
it
you
helped
were right?
me that he was that he reacted so violently. It gave me the drive to resist. I resisted him. And now he's gone, I'm grateful. I thank him. He made things difficult. But then it forced me to go further, you know.
Further and deeper.
Yeah, and deeper. I wanted to be amongst the best.
Actress Jeanne Moreau is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Jeanne Moreau. In the second movie that you made with Louis Malle, The Lovers, there's a long and very sensual, very romantic scene toward the end of the film.
Yeah.
In which you meet a man, and after a little bit of like resistance, you the two of you just like fall in love and take a long
They make love everywhere, and they make love all night long.
Right.
And it's very kind of you to say it's romantic. Now it's considered as romantic, I mean, compared to what one is able to see in films. But when it came out in the 60s, it was considered a real scandal. There are some countries where it was forbidden.
Well, the camera, you know, it's very clear that the couple is making love, but the camera is on your face and on your hand the whole time. And through the movements of your hands and the expression on your face, you know exactly what's happening, although you don't see
it. I think we should go back to that nowadays. I'm fed up of seeing buttocks and things, you know.
No, what did you think of the scene when it was shot? Did you feel that it crossed a boundary that it shouldn't have crossed? Or did you think it was beautiful?
It didn't come to my mind. My main preoccupation was my relationship with Louis Malle at the time. We were lovers, and I was passionately in love with him. And so immediately we started the film, I had a very strange feeling. It was as though the more I would give to Louis Malle as a director, the more I would open up to that character on screen, the less would be left of our personal relationship. You know, you understand what I mean? I don't know how you call those things that counts the time, those strange little objects.
An hourglass?
Yeah. And I had the impression that as the sand was falling on the lower part, then the last grain of sand would be the end of our relationship. And I was right.
Why did you think that?
I don't know.
Acting out love in front of the camera as
Mal directed. Because I was giving up something that was very personal and secret and intimate between me and him. Mm-hmm. And it's as though it was sacred. And I had the impression I was giving it to him as a film director to go exactly where he wanted to go as a filmmaker, and I had to pay the price. Maybe it's my Christian background, you know, Catholic background, but it worked that way. So I didn't bother to think about, is it going to be scandalous or what? No, I wanted to be as close to the truth, to the beautiful truth of love making and sensuality. And I see sensuality. I do not see sexuality. Because the thing I regret nowadays, it's that sex has deprived our people who relate to sex of their beauties, of that sacred spiritual beautiful glory of each human being, just to be considered like a piece of meat, a slice of steak. What is great in making love, it's that you mix both the senses and the love, and that's it. So I didn't think about scandal.
Do you think that Louis Malle had the same fears that somehow making the movie would end the real relationship?
Yes. Later on, we spoke about it. And he said that he felt the same. And I asked for something. Usually, I'm never keen on asking things, special things, to be on the set or in a frame in a film. At the end of the film, when she leaves the house with her lover, she's in one of those old little French cars, and they cross the landscape. And on the left side, there's a white horse. And I asked for the white horse. Because when I was a child, my grandmother and mother, when they saw a white horse, they would spit on the floor and say, white horse, give me good luck to me, good luck to you, and good luck to every white horse like you. And I wanted the last image to be goodbye to that love, but at the same time, good luck to the white horse and to me.
Was it worth the sacrifice of a relationship to make a great film?
Of course. It was not a sacrifice. It was symbolic. Because no love lasts as long as that, you know. And we had a beautiful love, and now we are great friends. And it ended there, and we made not only these two films, but later on, he had another lover, He came up and he asked me to play a part in another film of his. And we love each other in a different way.
I want to get back to your childhood. You told us that your father was dead set against you becoming an actress, that acting was like prostitution to him. But your mother, didn't she dance in the Folies Bergères?
Of course. She was a dancer.
And what did he think of that?
I loved it.
What did your father think of it?
Well, my father fell in love with her, maybe because she was a dancer and she was, you know. And she got pregnant. I mean, she married... She didn't marry a year before I was born. She married a few months before I was born. I think that she became a Catholic to be able to marry my father in the church while she was already pregnant. But you see, in the family, they always considered my mother like a strange person, a foreigner. She always spoke French with a lovely, adorable English accent.
And your mother was from England.
Yeah, she had been a dancer, and of course, I'm sure that I was part of the game between my father and my mother, because on one side my father was against it, and on the other side, my mother helped me.
Helped you to act?
She covered my lies, because very early I led a double life.
Oh, what did you do?
Well, I studied to be an actress, and my father didn't know.
Oh.
And I acted on the stage, and my father didn't know. He discovered it when he saw my picture on the front page of a newspaper.
Wow. Because you were in the Comédie Française, it would be hard to keep that a secret.
And my first play was a huge success, and I was on the front page of all the daily newspapers.
Well, he must have been mighty angry.
Well, he threw me out.
Where'd you go?
In a hotel.
How long did you have to stay there?
6 months.
It's a long time. Did you ever go back home after that?
No, never. But I made up with my father when I heard he was sick. About 4 years later, he was in hospital. And I went and I took him out. And after that, I always took care of him. And he spent the 10 last years of his life in my property. You would call that a ranch in the south of France.
Did he ever say to you, "You're actually a really good actress and you've made some fine films"?
Never.
Uh-huh.
Never. Never. He was proud when I had an official decoration, you know, the Legion of Honor and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he used to say, "I can't understand. What has she got that is so special?" He thought I was a very good cook. That he appreciated. And it's true, I'm a very good cook. That was his limit. I had to do things with my hands.
Uh-huh.
And I did.
You're living in France now?
I'm living in Paris.
Paris. Mm. Right. Okay.
I'm living alone. And
do you like living alone?
I need it.
There are a lot of pleasures in living alone. What do you enjoy about it?
The freedom to ask somebody to share my solitude.
That's very nicely put.
Yeah. That's so good sometimes, just to spread oneself in one's bed, get up at whatever time you wish. There are lots of pleasures.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it a lot.
I thank you very much. And to me, it was not like an interview. It was just like a conversation. And I think I'm very privileged to be able to speak about things that are important to me. And I thank you very much.
Jeanne Moreau, recorded in December 1993. Her latest film is The Summer House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Peter Coyote came to acting comparatively late in life, but he came to anarchy early. Coming up, the star of new films by Roman Polanski and Pedro Almodovar tells us about his early days performing radical street theater and working with the Haight-Ashbury collective, The Diggers. That's coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Southern Yemen says its military has shot down three northern military aircraft and damaged a warship today in the Red Sea. The battle reportedly took place close to the former north-south Yemeni border. The battle report has not been confirmed. Meanwhile, southern Yemen leaders are offering a peace plan calling for the immediate end of the 10-day-old civil war. They want to create a national salvation government. The southern plan calls on the rival armies to retreat to the positions they were in before the war started. The government says retail prices rose slightly in April. The Labor Department says the Consumer Price Index increased a modest 0.1%. Economist David Littman says the report is another indication that inflation is under control, despite worry that it is building.
Couldn't have asked for a better report to calm the fears of inflation that may have been haunting, especially the long-term bond markets. What this means is that year over year with a 2.3% inflation rate, and an actual deceleration of the rate of inflation since the beginning of this year, the real bond rate, that is after inflation, is about double its normal rate. That means there's a lot of latitude for the long-term interest rates, which have moved up very sharply, now to come down.
So far this year, the Consumer Price Index has risen at an annual rate of 2.3%. Lawmakers in Pennsylvania have prepared the way for the impeachment of a state Supreme Court justice. Robert Lang of member station WITF reports from Harrisburg.
The Pennsylvania House Judiciary Committee unanimously approved the resolution calling for the impeachment of state Supreme Court Justice Rolf Larson, who in April was convicted of illegally obtaining prescription drugs. A House subcommittee also found evidence Larson fixed cases involving his friends and lied to a state grand jury about it. Republican committee member Dan Clark.
His conduct, which he engaged in, is simply unacceptable. We cannot condone those actions.
The impeachment resolution now goes to the full House, and Democrat Frank Dermody, whose panel conducted the investigation, thinks impeachment should be approved within 2 weeks.
Once this is presented properly, once people see the evidence and it's explained to them, the questions go away.
For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Lang in Harrisburg.
An anti-abortion activist group is promising a legal challenge to legislation that blocks access to abortion clinics. The American Life League says it will seek an injunction to prevent the new law from taking effect. The American Center for Law and Justice, which backs anti-abortion activists, says the bill crushes the free speech rights of anti-abortion demonstrators. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 7 points to end at 3,659. Declining issues edged advances in heavy trading of 252 million shares. This is NPR. Russian lawmakers have passed a resolution urging President Boris Yeltsin to lift the arms embargo against Serbia if the United States or any other country starts supplying guns to the Bosnian government. The Senate has passed a bill requiring President Clinton to lift the arms embargo against the Bosnian government, and the Russian action is an angry response to that. But the Russian parliament has also voted to consult with the United Nations before doing anything. The Serbs are the historical allies of Russia. Germany is considering a law making it a crime to deny that the Holocaust occurred. Jewish groups are angry over a recent court ruling they say casts doubt on Germany's official position on the so-called Auschwitz lie. The BBC's William Horsley reports.
Germany's Jewish community leaders have expressed acute alarm at what they say is a revival of anti-Semitism, including an increased risk of violence against Jews and other minority groups, and they've accused the German authorities of failing to address the danger. Chancellor Kohl's government says that next week it will present a bill to Parliament making the Auschwitz lie an offence punishable by up to 3 years imprisonment. Extreme right-wing groups have grown in influence since German unification, and they seek to cast doubt on the facts of the Holocaust. Jewish and other groups were outraged in March at a judgment by Germany's Federal Court of Justice, the top court of appeal, which ruled in the case of one right-wing leader that his public denial of the Holocaust was not in itself an offence. The new law should end any doubt on that legal question.
William Horsley reporting. U.S. military officials are denying any connection between recent military exercises and plans to invade Haiti. A spokeswoman for the U.S. Atlantic Command says a giant mock invasion was planned over a year ago, and it was conducted with a Southwest Asia scenario. The exercises were held recently in North Carolina, Georgia, and at an airport in the Bahamas. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor Peter Coyote hasn't been satisfied with what Hollywood has to offer him, so he's been working in Europe. He stars in Roman Polanski's new film Bitter Moon and Pedro Almodovar's new film Kika. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're presenting a 1990 interview with Coyote. His American films include E.T., Jagged Edge, and Outrageous Fortune. He didn't start acting in films until his late 30s. Before that, most of his acting was in street theater. Coyote was a member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and he was a digger. The diggers were one of the most celebrated radical cultural groups of the 60s. They ran a free store and handed out free food in Golden Gate Park. Abby Hoffman described them as combining Dada street theater with the revolutionary politics of free. Coyote says the 60s continue to be trivialized and misunderstood. Of course, one of the culprits is Hollywood. Films about that time seldom get it right. Coyote almost directed a sequence in one of the classic 60s films, Easy Rider, but the negotiations with Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda fell through at the last minute.
These guys assumed that we were all kind of flower children or something. So when Peter and Dennis offered me $20 a week and to sleep on their couch to do this film, we passed, and I had hoped to put a bunch of really hungry actors to work. And so they put a sequence in Easy Rider of a guerrilla theater troupe, spelled G-O-R-I-L-L-A, bunch of old hookers and people of dubious sexual persuasion mincing around in tights, which I took great affront to. And that film in particular seemed to suggest that if you lived the way that my friends and I were living, you were going to get killed by some redneck in the South. And aside from the splendor of getting Jack Nicholson in that film, everything else about it was totally wrong.
This idea of offering you $20 a week and a couch to sleep on, do you think that people thought just because you had run free stores and given away free food that you'd be perfectly happy to work for free?
I think so. Or, you know, I mean, it took a lot of money and a lot of energy to live free. I have to point that out. And the diggers were pretty mysterious about how and where we got that money. And we did that for a reason. And usually we would give away any money that was given to us in front of the people who gave it to us.
Peter Coyote is my guest. In your introduction to Ringolevio, you describe yourself and the people who you were with during the 60s as life actors. Now, as someone who is a professional actor now, what do you mean by life actor?
Well, it occurred to a number of us one day that we were writing these plays to excoriate the politics of the middle class, and they were giving us medals. We had won an Obie in New York in 1967. And it occurred to us that theater was not going to be a vehicle for radical change, because when you paid admission at the door, you knew in your deepest bone marrow that it was a business. And if you didn't like the conclusions or the point of view that was put forward on the stage, it was like going into a store where you didn't like the merchandise. You just left. Nothing really challenged the question of storeness. Should there be a store at all? So we thought, what would happen if we would take our same aesthetic impulses and imagination and improvisatory abilities and play them out in real life and use situations as props to to try to enlighten people to cultural alternatives that were not available, and to do it theatrically, but in a way in which no one could claim it was theater, where it was real life, and people had to come up and look at their responses as the in the same way that they would look at themselves in everyday life. So we tried to create situations where we and the other people involved were thrown in over their heads, where they were forced into new situations, like a free store. You go into a store and not only are all the goods free, but so are the roles. So someone might come and ask for the manager, and the response would be, well, you're the manager, what shall we do today? And you keep playing around with them until they take it seriously, and at which point they become the manager. They get to try out their idea of what a free store might be, and everyone in the store will go along with it. So that would be an example of life acting.
It seems to me that the idea of life acting also covered your own identities. I mean, a lot of the people in The Diggers, I think, recreated themselves. You know, Emmick Rogan had been Eugene Grogan. You had been Peter Kohan. Am I pronouncing that right? And, I mean, you found new names for yourselves and, in a way, I think, new identities as well. Is that right?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, my relationship to my name was, I would say, more religious than political. But I definitely think it's true that when you grow up in a culture, your reality or your identity is circumscribed by that culture. There are certain options that are open to you. You know, Peter Kohan was this kind of a person, and he had these kind of expectations welded onto his identity. And at a certain point, if you want to break into new territory, you have to leave that identity behind.
Was there a part of yourself that you felt, or your own background that you were struggling against?
Yeah. I grew up with a lot of expectations about the right ways of doing things. For a period in my life, my family had had a lot of money, and I knew that I was being deprived of true tests of my worth. I was being sheltered by this money and by certain kinds of privilege. And so that was something that I wanted to find out who I was and to test myself against the same standards that people without privilege faced. And that meant you had to go to some kind of free territory where your address or your name was meaningless. You couldn't live in the same town. If the cops stopped you and asked where you lived and you gave an address on Booth Avenue, you were going to be treated differently than a black kid who lived on 2nd Street. It was built into the system. So I think that's one reason why a lot of kids who were really serious about getting in touch with their authenticity fled to the free territories of the Lower East Side and Berkeley and Haight-Ashbury, because it was a place where you would be taken for who you were and how you behaved, and you would pay real dues.
Did you ever feel that if somebody found out about your background, that you had been from a privileged background, your father, I think, had been president of a railroad company and an oil company, that it would be a way of dismissing you? You know, like, well, sure, he's working at a free store, but he's from a privileged background.
No, I was never afraid of that. I had a problem. For instance, in the 60s, we had no money, and we lived in a very impoverished fashion. And yet my personal standards of excellence and elegance were groomed by the best museums and best art and access to a heightened spectrum of possibilities. And so I had a lot of ideas about elegance and excellence and standards that I had to sort through. How was I going to live without money and still manifest my idea of living up to certain standards of mind, not of wealth or value, but just standards of achievement or order of mind? How was I going to do that? So, for instance, I lived in this truck, but my truck was fastidious. You know, it was beautifully painted, and everything was repaired, and everything was stowed in little boxes and little tchotchkes and this and that. And a lot of people did that. And I was not a very good craftsman. Some of the gypsy truckers that I lived with were cabinet makers, and their trucks were works of art. They were impeccable.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Peter Coyote. He's currently starring in new films by Pedro Almodovar and Roman Polanski.
More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Peter Coyote.
One of the things that the Diggers became really well known for was free stores, giving out free food. I remember I was living in Buffalo in 1969 and 1970, and there was a free store there, and I remember once it was ripped off. And it's like, what does it mean when a free store is ripped off? Did you ever go through a little kind of a crisis of confusion about that?
No, it was... It was a crisis of humor. I thought it was fabulous coming to work in the free store one day, and it was a big, kind of large black woman who was furtively shoving clothes in a paper bag. And I went over equally furtively, and I kept watch, and I would shove things into the bag, and pretty soon we were in collusion, and we were jamming things into this paper bag, and she leaned over to me and she said in kind of a throaty whisper, where's the boss? And I said, I'm the boss. And she looked at me stunned, and I said, it's a free store. And she just stopped. She just didn't know what to do. I said, it's a free store. It's yours. She said, everything? I said, my job. She said, your job? I said, yeah. Then she said, get out of my face. So I just walked away, and she just blatantly went around the store and collected what she needed and left. So that was a piece of theater for her and for me.
We were talking about how you had this like old and new identity, and I think they came together in a way when your father died. You went back with some of your friends from the Diggers. You went back to your mother's place to help her, I guess, recover from the death and also recover from the debt that your father had left her in. Was that an unusual experience to have the two worlds, the world of your family and the world of your friends, brought together for a while?
Boy, that was completely schizophrenic. I was never more out of my depth in my life. I went back and I was in this truck with wooden sides and a canvas cover. My mom was widowed. My dad had been a partnership, not a corporation. So everything was up for grabs, cattle ranches and homes and businesses, and it was millions of dollars in debt, and the creditors were literally pulling at her over the coffin. And the business had run through a huge land sale in about 10 days, and my mom was going to be on the street, and nobody was really helping her at all. So I walked into a barber shop one day, and I cut my hair. All I could sit on it. The barber couldn't believe this. I cut my hair. I borrowed a suit from my mom, $150. I bought a suit. And we got all the creditors together. And basically I said, I've come back from the coast to be a rich and famous capitalist. And unless you absolve us of debt, interest on debt, which at that time was about $385,000 a year, I'm going to close the business and you'll get a nickel on the dollar. So they did that for a year. And I went into New York, and I became a registered representative in 10 days. I became a stockbroker. And my father's salesman, of course, had stolen all his customers, and they gave me a book about 4 inches thick with the name of every company that employed two or more people in the state of New York. And I started making blind phone calls 8 hours a day. Hi, I'm calling from Morris Cohen and Company. We'd like to sell you the opportunity to desecrate Hawaii for $12 a share. And I did this. Then, because my daughter's mother at that time and my mother were not getting along, I moved up to the family farm, and she couldn't stay by herself, and so various friends from California came by, and we basically replicated one of our communes on the family farm. So Monday morning, I would get up and I would go to Wall Street by bus, and I'd stay in the city till Thursday afternoon. And then I'd get off the bus, I'd change into my work clothes, and I'd do farm work because our old neighbor had broken his back, and we were milking 60 of his cows and making hay and doing all this stuff for him for barter, you know, a ton of potatoes and 9 pigs. And so I would do manual labor Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then get back on the bus and go into New York. And I think that in the 10 months that I did that, I probably sold 2 stocks. And I had no idea what I was doing. I was never more out of my depth. And although I did manage to get my dad's insurance money from my mom, which she basically lives on today. She went out and got a job in her 60s, her first job in 40 years maybe. So it was a very, very surreal time. And, of course, my mother didn't understand these crazy people, and neither did all the people in this little town in Pennsylvania that I'd grown up in. All of a sudden, all these crazy people are around, you know, with long hair and funky trucks, and they're living in the outbuildings. And instead of being this showplace farm that was funded from all this Wall Street theft, it was turning into a large hippie artifact. And it was a very, very bizarre time.
Oh, boy, it sounds really crazy.
We ultimately lost the farm. We were all evicted, and that's all she wrote. It was 35 years of work on my dad's part.
Wow. It's funny, don't you think, that many of the roles you're best known for are roles in which you've played, say, a government agent in E.T. or a district attorney in Jagged Edge, just exactly the kind of people who you haven't been.
Well, I think there's a kind of cultural bias that equates intelligence with malevolence. And I don't know why that is, but if the script says smart and evil, I'll get it. If the script says gorgeous and sexy, they'll send it to Kevin Costner. I don't know what it is. I think that it's that I have an ability to translate complex people and to humanize some of these people that might otherwise be just stereotypes. And so I get called on to do that. The only problem with that is that unless you get the girl, you don't really get the power and the authority and the money. But I certainly am having a good time being an actor. And I can't complain because it's such an unstable occupation. There are so many people that would envy my problems.
Do you feel that you've become the person you wanted to be?
No, I think I'm still working on it. I haven't found the edges, you know. And I much prefer the surprise and the invisibility of constantly looking.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on Fresh Air.
Peter Coyote, recorded in 1990. He's starring in Roman Polanski's new film Bitter Moon and Pedro Almodovar's Kika. This is Fresh Air. Europe has proposed a new plan to resume peace talks in Bosnia. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Sylvia Poggioli will be talking with us, Terry, to tell us what it means and what she thinks is going to happen next. We also are continuing with the Culture War series. Katie Davis has a piece in which she spent some time with a Navajo family. In Jericho, the Palestinian police have moved into that city and are in authority. We'll have a report. And we have an interview with Abraham Verghese, who has written a book called My Own Country. It's about a doctor and a town, Johnson City, Tennessee, confronting AIDS.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In her new book, Where the Girls Are, media theorist Susan J. Douglas looks at TV characters like Mary Richards and Aunt Bee, singers like Joan Baez and the Dixie Cups, magazines like 17 and movies like Cinderella, to discuss the mass media's treatment of women over the past 40 years. Critic Maureen Corrigan says she hasn't had this much fun reading about pop culture icons since her subscription to Tiger Beat expired.
When I came upon these two sentences in Susan J. Douglas's new book, Where the Girls Are, I knew for sure I was in the company of a very wise pop culture guide. Douglas writes, "It's not embarrassing, after all these years, to admit that Audrey Hepburn's Holly Golightly had a strong impact on you when you were young. But it takes a certain amount of guts to admit you bonded on some primal, coursing level with Cricket Blake. Now, I could barely turn a TV dial in 1959, but I remember Cricket. She was a dizzy, blonde nightclub singer played by Connie Stevens on the detective show Hawaiian Eye. Cricket is not the kind of character most feminist media theorists want to rescue. But Douglas insists baby boomer women need to reclaim all their pop culture past, the good, the bad, and the bouncy. Sometimes these kinds of whirlwind excursions into pop history can be educational but arid. Douglas, however, is a snappy, opinionated writer. For instance, she launches into a brilliant reading of the tensions between feminism and anti-feminism contained within that quintessential bionic bimbo show, Charlie's Angels. But before she does this, Douglas pleads to her skeptical readers, "Try to hold your nose and bear with me." Holding your nose while you're laughing or groaning is tough to do, but the effort is worth it. Where the Girls Are deftly explores how the mass media has made many of us women what we are today, cultural schizophrenics who rebel against yet submit to the prevailing images of what a desirable woman should be. Because Douglas's book encompasses tons of material, I can only channel surf through some of its highlights. In a chapter entitled, Why the Shirelles Mattered, Douglas demonstrates how those much-ridiculed girl groups of the 1950s and 60s sang about what most girls couldn't say, that is, their contradictory feelings about their own sexuality. We get the erotic spectrum here, everything from the Ronettes' aggressive Be My Baby to the doormat lyrics of Chains, sung by the Cookies. In a later section, Douglas defends teenage TV icons like Gidget and Patty Duke, saying their nauseating perkiness was a useful strategy for girls who wanted to take an active role in the world, yet still appeal to men. And in her final chapter on present-day mixed media messages, Douglas considers how cosmetic ads and exercise programs like Buns of Steel have co-opted the language of women's liberation. Where the Girls Are is shaped by Douglas's personal memories of growing up female with pop culture. So despite its voluminousness, it does leave out some of my favorite formative years shows, like Dark Shadows and Here Come the Brides. But that's a minor quibble. Many women today have ambivalent attitudes towards feminism. Susan J. Douglas does a great job of excavating the origins of this ambivalence in the twisted, trash heap images of flying nuns, secret agents, and Watusi dancing beach bunnies.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Where the Girls Are by Susan J. Douglas. Our program was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
You don't know.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ice-T talks with us about his life and gangster rap. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.